The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Laura Downs is an accomplished musician, a pianist who has collaborated with a wide-ranging variety of people, including cellist Yo-Yo Ma, pianist Simona Dinnerstein, folk icon Judy Collins, baritone Thomas Hampson, writer Adam Gopnik, and former U.S. poet laureate Rita Dove. Her recordings have celebrated phenomenal women of the past, present, and future of American music. The 200th birthday of the great pianist and composer Clara Schumann, and world premieres of newly discovered works by Florence Price and Margaret Bonds. And that's just scratching the surface of Laura Downs' many accomplishments, projects, and interests. And she is joining me via Zoom to talk about some of them. Welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be with you today.
So, you know, these are really challenging times for everyone during this lockdown of many, many months now. And so I want to ask you first, with so many special challenges for musicians especially, how are you doing?
I'm learning a lot. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing okay. I mean, it's been, you know, there have been various phases of this. And I think I'm in like phase three, which is just really busy doing new things in new ways. You know, I think we've all had the same experience. The beginning of this was really hard and just so sudden and so devastating. And then I think I figured out really quickly that whatever this was, whatever this time was going to be, I just wanted to be in it. So, you know, lying on the floor and crying was not what I wanted to do. So, you know, I picked myself up and dusted myself off. And it's been a time of a lot of growth and a lot of creativity and a lot of, I think, just reimagining and also imagining what is the future after this.
Yeah. I a number of my musician friends have said that they went through at least initially a period of kind of walking away from music, not practicing, and just really feeling sort of at sea. So it's interesting you talk about the different phases. Did you go through that phase at all? Were you kind of walked away from your music?
Well, I did. And, you know, in a practical sense, that was because when everything got canceled, you know, there was no need, right? And I had always wondered this, to be honest. I can't remember the last time I didn't have deadlines or, you know, goals set in terms of what I was practicing for, really, right? Since I was a small child. So I always kind of wondered in the back of my mind if I didn't have things on my calendar, deadlines and, you know, benchmarks, would I practice and how would I practice, you know, and what would it feel like? And in that moment of just the massive cancellation of everything, I didn't have the energy to figure that out. So I just stopped getting ready for the things that no longer needed to be gotten ready for. But then I think a big part for me of being in this time has been allowing myself to respond musically to this time. And that means being really spontaneous and doing things quickly and doing things that feel right. And, you know, and also this whole world of virtual performance kicked in pretty fast. So it wasn't that long before I was calling, I mean, between the time that I was calling the airlines and canceling all my tickets and then like actually having new commitments that I had to figure out how to do from home with new technology and, you know, a new approach. It was actually in retrospect quite short.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing when you're, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? You know, you've got to do it, you do it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, some of it, we had different responses. I think some of us just felt, well, I don't know how to do this thing and I can't, you know, I don't have it in me. And I'm a person who kind of enjoys having giant stones put in front of me so I can push them aside. So I think I jumped in really quickly and learned by, how do you say it? when you learn by mistakes, like I
trial by error.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The first live streams I did were not pretty. But that just motivated me to figure it out and do it well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. So you alluded to this actually, because I was going to ask you next about your early introduction to music. It sounds like you really, you know, became a musician as a very little girl. So could you talk about that a little bit? Did you start on the piano, or were you honking away on a recorder like a lot of little kids? Or, you know, what was your introduction to music? And more importantly, too, like, at what point and how did you know that music really is your life's work?
Mm-hmm. So it's funny. I do think that my first formed memory of childhood is at the piano. And it was before, I know it was before I was four, because when I was four, I started real piano lessons. So this is maybe two or three. And I was in one of those little baby music classes, you know, mm-hmm. where you bang on things and whistle on things. And I was sitting at the piano with the teacher, and she was showing me something. And there was this little boy who was crawling around on the floor underneath the piano, you know, distracting her. And I remember feeling so annoyed at him, and also just so bewildered that he wasn't interested. And I don't have that many memories from early childhood. So it's remarkable to me that that one is as clear as it is. So, I grew up at the piano. So many things that I learned in the context of music. My sisters and I were homeschooled. So, you know, music was really pretty much all day, every day. And, you know, like I have this memory of my mom trying to teach me like basic fractions and not getting it because I don't have a math brain. And then when it was put in the context of, oh, but you know, it's like your eighth notes and it's like your triplets, then it made sense. So it's really, that was just the framework for my childhood. And I don't think I ever decided, to be a musician. I think I just never decided not to be a musician, you know, right? There was a time when I was maybe 12 or so that I really wanted to be an actress. And then there was another moment when I wanted to be an archaeologist. And I think that those things have just come together in my music, because I love the digging around, you know, excavating, okay. researching part. And I mean, I think that as a musician, you are portraying characters and emotions all the time. So yeah, here I am.
Well, again, that's another really perfect segue, because one of the things I found so intriguing was this summary that you have on your website. It's kind of your personal statement, and you've declared that you have a musical roadmap that seeks inspiration from the legacies of history, family, and collective memory. That's a really beautiful and very poetic way of putting it. It's also a very intriguing way to summarize that, and I would like you to explain what that means to you.
I mean, I think maybe a more serious answer to your last question is that I have thrived as a musician and grown as a musician because I have made music the place where I find understanding of myself, of the world, of the conflicts that exist within that world. I just feel like every time there's a big question for me, music is where I go back to. And, you know, that may have something to do with this childhood that was so rooted in music through difficult times, because my father was very sick and died when I was really small. And mm-hmm. music was like a constant thing. You know, music was the only constant thing when there was so much turbulence in our family's life. And, you know, music has been my pathway to understanding my identity as a woman, as an American woman, as a biracial American woman. Music has been my pathway to understanding, you know, a lot of what divides us as human beings and connects us as human beings. And I like it better than therapy.
Yeah. So, like a lot of musicians, you have demonstrated an affinity for music by Johann Sebastian Bach. And you did something really fascinating and innovative with your recording, 13 Ways of Looking at the Goldbergs, and you reimagined Bach's Goldberg Variations through the lens of, you know, other composers. And I would like you to talk a little bit about that project and, you know, what inspired it and maybe what your relationship is with Bach's music.
Mm-hmm. So I should say I didn't that project did not initiate with me. That was a project that was commissioned by the Gilmore Foundation and premiered by Gil Kalish. And then I just came along and discovered it and was really intrigued. Funny, you know, Bach again is one of those earliest childhood memories. And my father was a great music lover, and the two places where my memories of him connect with music are through Bach and through jazz. And he would just listen to music in the evenings when he came home from work, and I would sit with him in the living room, and I remember listening to Glenn Gould's Goldbergs with him. His name was also Glenn. And I think, you know, as any good hipster of the time, he was a huge fan of Glenn Gould. And so, you know, that music is there. So this reimagining of the Goldberg Variations was, you know, again, like sort of a path back to childhood and to connection with my own family. And it's a really amazing undertaking. And talking with some of the composers who are involved, you know, Bach is the colossus, right? So to reimagine, and even what does that mean to reimagine, you know, to take this theme and create something new out of it was a tremendous undertaking. And there's a really wide variety within the set of approaches to that, of, you know, the elements that are chosen to make the foundation of something new. And I think a lot of my work and a lot of the places that energize me have to do with taking something old and making something new, and, you know, taking this tradition that we love so much that is from such a long time ago, and finding the places that connect it in relevance and context to our current existence on the planet.
Mm-hmm. It's I think often surprising, particularly to people who are not musicians, to learn that musicians, it's not just classical musicians who revere Bach, study Bach, have Bach internalized. That, I mean, there are rap musicians, there are, you know, jazz musicians. There, I mean, it is not all ours. You know, there's a universality to it and application to it. So.
Mm-hmm. On so many different levels, right? I think that there are things about Bach that appeal to us in many different ways. I haven't even gotten to the bottom of my understanding about that. It's very profound. But yeah, if you look at just the ways that, you know, rhythmically and, you know, when I again, back to Glenn Gould, I think that was like this weird collision, right, of Bach and bebop and, you know, just like this kind of new freedom of that time and place. Yeah. I think, yeah.
So you have a new project, and this is very much your own project, and it's all you, and it's Amplify with Lara Downs, a collaboration with NPR Music, and you are offering for people to eavesdrop on intimate conversations with visionary Black musicians, and these are biweekly video interviews, and then you just kicked it off with a conversation with your friend, the musician Rihanna Giddens, who's artistic director of Silk Road, and a whole lot more, just like you. It was delightful. I just watched it, and it's warm, and it's honest, and it's informal and funny, and, you know, you're in front of your piano, and she's, I think, in her kitchen or something. She's, you know, like nursing a mug of coffee, and it's clearly this just like authentic exchange. Like, we could have like opened the door and, oh, look, they're hanging out having a conversation. It's really just, it's lovely. It's, there's no, you know, artifice about it. It's very genuine and authentic. And, you know, you covered topics that drew me in because, again, there was a universality about them. Not just music, but things like scheduling, you know, when you now have to do things virtually and you had to schedule things before, you know, by flying places and lockdown and things about like the truth of history and this current moment in the world and tearing down the facade of presenting things as perfect and instead kind of, you know, wearing your jammies on a conference call or whatever that might be. So I would love for you to talk about how this came about and, you know, what you see as its goal, its evolution, like where you want this to go.
First of all, thank you for saying such nice things. And I love that conversation too. And I've loved this opportunity to connect with fellow musicians. And this developed because early on in the pandemic, when I had nothing to do and I was sad, I just started reaching out to, you know, some friends and colleagues. And on two levels, I think that, you know, one of the first positive things to emerge was just having the time to kind of pay more attention to relationships. Because it's funny, just before lockdown, one of my last trips before lockdown, I was in Boston working with Helga Davis, wonderful colleague and dear friend. And I had been on the road for I don't know how many weeks and really, really sick and moving around to all these different cities, and finally got to Boston and got to be with Helga. And it was really cold in Boston. And one evening on my way back to the hotel from rehearsal, I saw Jason Moran, jazz pianist, coming off of the elevator. And Jason and I hadn't seen each other in a long time. And Jason and Helga are friends. And we just all happened to be in town together. And we had dinner that night. And one of the things we talked about was how crazy our lives were and how little we were able to connect and spend time with the people who we care about and who inspire us and who are like in our, you know, our process, like this community of artists. We don't get to feed off of each other nearly as much as people think. It's such an isolated life, right? It was isolated before. It was like isolated before we were isolated. So long way to say that early in the pandemic, I really needed that connection. And I started to discover really quickly that while we were all sad and while we were feeling, you know, this incredibly overwhelming stoppage of everything in our normal lives, at the same time, we were understanding things and learning things and starting to envision a new way just very quickly, just like I said, I was, you know, it was this very organic process. And I thought these are really important conversations because I think that as with all periods of catastrophe and tragedy and devastation, out of this comes something new, certainly. Out of this comes, you know, global shift, cultural shift. And when does that happen? It happens during the moment of crisis. And so to capture that during the moment of crisis, I thought was really interesting. And, you know, I was talking specifically to artists of color. And of course, during all of this, that has been such a unique and strange and powerful place to be, because our lives as creative artists were impacted first by the pandemic and then by, you know, this season of racial violence and racial reckoning. So we've kind of found ourselves at two centers at once. And I really wanted to capture the energy that was coming out of that. And so these conversations have been, I think, incredibly enlightening and really important documents of this time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can't help but notice and admire your, you know, your creative positivity. I mean, you have an optimism and a way of sort of putting that, I don't know, that, and I don't want to say spin because that sounds a little pejorative, but I mean, you have a way of really sort of turning lemons into lemonade, if you will, you know, really just kind of making something really extraordinary out of a moment. So I really admire that.
Thank you. But you know, if you look around, if you look back, I think that most great things, most beautiful mm-hmm. things don't come out of everything just being fine, right? Mm-hmm. They Absolutely. Really don't. Both on the personal level, I think we make our best work when we are struggling to find something within ourselves. Mm-hmm. We make our best work when we're struggling to cope with the world around us. And mm-hmm. Maybe that's kind of at the heart of what draws me to music in the first place is, yeah. you know, that part of the humanity in it.
Yeah. I don't want to skip over your new recording of music by Florence Price and Margaret Bonds. So I do want to double back and let you talk a little bit about them, because although it's not Baroque music, it's amazing music and people should really listen to this because they've been unfairly overlooked for way too long.
You know, and it's funny because when I talk about this music, when I talk about Florence Price and Margaret Bonds and any number of other composers whose music I've had a hand in excavating, I always remind people that we wouldn't know the Bach cello suites if Casals hadn't found the music in, you know, a secondhand bookstore, right?
Right.
Like the things that we take for granted could so easily have disappeared. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so this is an ongoing process. And I think that it is getting easier because of technology that we have. And I think that there are many, many more discoveries to come. So Florence Price, should I quickly introduce
who
she is? Yeah. Florence Price was just a remarkable woman. She was born in 1877 in Little Rock, Arkansas, African American mixed race family. Her father was the first successful African-American dentist in America. Her mother was a music teacher, so success and accomplishment were things that were valued and prioritized. And she was a musical prodigy, and the music was encouraged. And she actually went to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. On her application form, her mother had her write Mexican under race so that admission would be simpler. And then during a period of racial horror, just a horrifying period in Arkansas, lynchings and race riots and just a terrible time, she and her husband decided to move up to Chicago as, you know, part of the Great Migration. And she had this incredible career there. She wrote and wrote and wrote so much music. And to me, the fascinating thing is that, you know, here was this person whose ambition was to be part of the Western classical canon, who had studied at NEC, who was writing, you know, big symphonic works and ambitious chamber and solo works, but she held on to the language of her people. She held on. There was always this presence of the music of the Black Church, of the Black South, spirituals, using a lot of themes from spirituals in her music. Mm-hmm. And she had this historic moment in 1933 when she won a composition competition in Chicago and had her first symphony performed by the Chicago Symphony at the World's Fair. So, you know, first time that music by an African-American female composer was ever performed by a major symphony orchestra in this country. And, you know, lots of teaching, it was such a flourishing time in Chicago. It was the Black Renaissance in Chicago, as in Harlem. And then after her death, people moved on and forgot about her. And her music was, in fact, lost and only discovered in 2009 in the wreck of an abandoned house outside Chicago. Mm. And the young couple who was renovating this house just found these manuscripts literally scattered around a house that had been, you know, just vandalized. And I mean, I have pictures. It's incredible. And saw this signature and did a little bit of work to find out who this composer was. And the music ended up in the archives at the University of Arkansas. And there's one piece of hers that had been published years ago. I don't even know the circumstances, but one of her first fantasies had been published. I had played it, I had recorded it, really important piece in my musical journey. And so I sort of encouraged a musicologist colleague and friend named Michael Cooper to go down to those boxes and dig through. And he did, and started editing all this music, which is now available via Shermer. But I spent a lot of time and energy recording all this music and put it out. And it's been an incredible process because the music is beautiful. The music is, mm-hmm. you know, just so kind of needed in our ears. And so is her story. And I'll tell you, I have never experienced, I've done a lot of recording and I've had, really beautiful successes with my recordings, but I've never experienced what is happening with this music where I'm hearing multiple times a week from listeners who are hearing the music on streaming services or radio and are going to the trouble to find me and write and say, where can I find this music? And, you know, that's the really beautiful thing about it.
Yeah. 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 And what about Margaret Bonds?
Margaret Bonds, close friend of Florence Price, protege, a bit younger. They were very, very close. And she was a fine pianist. So she wrote some really wonderful works for piano. She also developed a close collaboration with Langston Hughes and wrote some really wonderful songs on his text. So I've been working with her solo music and also with her vocal music. And again, just such an interesting figure who kind of lived through a transition, like a cultural transition, you know, in her time. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there's just something about the power of creativity. You know, I think especially when we're talking about writers of color and women and people whose circumstances really, really got in the way. And what is it that motivates you to get up, you know, another morning and write another piece of music that maybe nobody's even asking you to write?
Mm-hmm.
That's a strong thing.
Well, in a way, it sort of relates to what we were talking about before, you know, of being a musician and not having any gigs on the horizon and still forging ahead. And so, you can't not do it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So who can we expect and hope to hear you chat with on Amplify in the future? I know you've got a few others scheduled, and I'm wondering if you'd like to talk about that, but also, like, who's on your wish list? Maybe somebody you haven't nailed down yet.
Yeah. you know who I'm trying to connect with? Terrence Blanchard, who is the composer of the first opera that will be presented at the Metropolitan Opera by a Black composer. And I really want to talk to him about the process of, you know, writing this piece, which he it's called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and it's based on a personal memoir that's really, you know, just a profound and powerful narrative about, you know, the Black experience. And just, you know, this moment that we're in on sort of the personal front and the institutional front of opening the doors and redefining these things, redefining the canon and redefining audience and community and cultural leadership. I think that there are so many people right now who are just at the forefront of something new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you have Anthony McGill next up, right?
So next Saturday, my guest is Anthony McGill, who is, you know, so well known as the leading clarinetist in our country and the first clarinet of the New York Phil, and just a beautiful musician. And I always call him a musician's musician because he's just, mm-hmm. you know, this stellar example of artistry. And Anthony had kind of this moment of self-discovery and awakening this spring in the wake of the killing of George Floyd 2 days after that in May, where he picked up his clarinet in the morning and played this solo version of America the Beautiful that migrates from its original into a minor key and is left unfinished. And then Anthony went down and took two knees and posted this video to social media with a call to musicians, you know, to take two knees because one knee wasn't enough, and just to respond and to pass it on and to create an energy. And, you know, it circulated widely and there was a huge response. And we just sat down together and talked about, you know, how that is, that in the business, being a musician and prioritizing your music making, because that's your calling and that's your job and that's, you know, what you do every day of your life. How does it happen that you're artistry and your ambassadorship and your activism all of a sudden collide and take you into a new space and put you in a totally different position in terms of your own capacity to make change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, you're going to talk to Anthony's brother, Damari?
Yeah, I would love to talk to Damari too.
Pretty amazing talent in that
family, right?
Yeah.
Well, I have been speaking with pianist Lara Downs, versatile performer, host of the new interview series Amplify with Lara Downs. Thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been great.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.